From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, October 12th, 2018. And on this day, we'll have an update on the allegation of sex discrimination against Sean Moody and his reaction to it. And we'll look at question 4 on the November ballot, which UMaine system officials say would fund its workforce efforts. That's ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, presenting Gardens Aglow, where visitors will see the gardens in a whole new light. Tickets available at mainegardens.org.
As we've been hearing today, Republican gubernatorial candidate Sean Moody is fending off allegations that he fired a female employee 12 years ago because he didn't think she could continue working while also caring for her newborn son. The allegations were originally detailed in a complaint to the Maine Human Rights Commission by Jill Hayward, a woman who was fired from Moody's collision centers while on maternity leave. Hayward terminated the complaint after she and Moody reached a settlement in 2006, but she renewed her allegations in a story published by the New York Times. Moody's campaign's pushing back hard against the allegations, which he says are not consistent with his track record as a business owner. We have brought in chief political correspondent Steve Missler to help break down the story and what it might mean for his campaign. Steve, my understanding is that Jill Hayward worked for Moody's company for about 3 years around 2003, and according to her complaint to the Maine Human Rights Commission, she apparently went on maternity leave late in 2005. What happened after that?
So according to the complaint, Hayward was on maternity leave when Moody informed her that she could no longer work for his company. The complaint attributes a number of statements to him, but they all center on the idea that he didn't think Hayward would be able to do her job because she was a single mother and her responsibilities would be to her son, not the company. Now, we don't have any formal rebuttal of these allegations. Under Maine law, Moody was required to respond to the complaint within 30 days. But his attorney asked for an extension and then later notified the Human Rights Commission that Moody and Hayward were negotiating a settlement. And that settlement came just a few months after, and Hayward eventually withdrew the complaint. So we were basically left with a human rights complaint that was settled privately 12 years ago and nobody has talked about until now.
And that's because of the New York Times story that was published today?
Correct. So these allegations have been in the public record for years. The problem is that Hayward never agreed to talk about them publicly. So there was very little for the Maine press to report other than the fact that Moody had reached this settlement. But Hayward talked to the Times, and she provided a lot more detail than one could possibly glean from that human rights complaint. The one detail that stands out is this scene that Hayward describes when Moody fires her. She says he came to her apartment when she was on leave and basically told her she could no longer do the job and that she was being let go. Now, we've asked Moody to confirm whether this scene has happened, and he's just declined to address it, saying that the agreement prohibits him from even talking about it. The Times asked him the very same question and received the same response. And in each instance, Moody is suggesting that responding to those allegations would violate that agreement. When he was asked about it today at a press conference, here's what he said.
Honestly, we have never let anyone go in this company for any other reason other than performance-related issues, period.
Do we know anything about the agreement? Any details?
No. I mean, we've asked for a copy of it, and so far we haven't been able to get one. The key question here is whether that agreement prohibits either Moody or Hayward from talking about these allegations. If that's the case, does Hayward going public with her story mean that Moody can too? And we've asked that question of him, and he seems to think that he's not allowed to talk about it, even though she has. Instead, they're taking an approach that these allegations are totally out of character for Moody. And Moody described the resurfacing of those allegations as a political hit.
We have a credible, reputable person, business, and company that's being attacked for political benefit and gain. It's not right. And I hope the Maine people will say, you know what, November rolls around. Let's show the people out there that have the big bucks, the billionaires, that Maine's not for sale and this election's not for sale.
Of course, the big question here is how does this affect Moody's campaign?
Well, it could certainly be very damaging to him. Now, keep in mind that there is no record of other human rights violations against Moody's or his business, according to the Human Rights Commission files. But one allegation like this can have an impact on a political campaign. especially with Moody. Moody's built his entire campaign on his success as a businessman and the fact that he overcame a difficult childhood. He was raised by a single mother, which is exactly the same circumstance confronting his accuser, Ms. Hayward. And these allegations also come against the backdrop of the Me Too movement, even though this is a discrimination case, not a sexual harassment case. But that movement is expected to contribute to a big turnout year for women voters. Moody's lead rival in the governor's race is Janet Mills, who is not only attempting to become the first woman elected governor of Maine, but she's also trying to harness this movement among women voters. In that context, these 12-year-old allegations are a real problem for Sean Moody.
Steve Missler is our chief political correspondent. Thanks, Steve, for joining us.
Happy to do it.
A Dixmont man facing criminal charges stemming from a mental health crisis that led to a 20-hour standoff with Maine State Police is free on probation. Today, a Penobscot Superior Court judge accepted a plea agreement for 62-year-old Michael Grindel. While he avoids jail time, he'll have to find a new home. Patty White has more.
Michael Grindel faced charges of criminal threatening with a dangerous weapon and reckless conduct with a dangerous weapon. They're related to an incident in June when he chased and shot at his best friend while experiencing a mental health crisis. In court on Friday, expert witness Dr. Robert Riley, a psychologist, testified that Grindel is being treated for major depressive disorder with psychotic features and does not pose a risk to himself or others. Justice Anne Murray agreed and accepted a plea agreement that suspends a 3.5-year prison sentence for Grindel. He'll be on probation for 4 years.
I don't think there's anybody that's not satisfied with today's outcome.
David Bate is Grindel's attorney. Under the conditions of Grindel's probation, he can't own any firearms or other dangerous weapons. He's not allowed to use or possess drugs or alcohol, and he must participate in any necessary treatment for substance use and mental health disorders. Penobscot County Deputy District Attorney Marianne Lynch says the plea agreement acknowledges the mental health issue at play in the case and the fact that Grindel accepts responsibility for his actions.
He's been medication compliant. His physical injuries also render him less likely to be a risk in the future.
Grindel walked into the courtroom with the aid of a cane. He currently uses a feeding tube and has hearing loss. He sustained the injuries after police responded to his mental health crisis, but became engaged in a 20-hour standoff. Authorities tried to lure Grindel out of his home by issuing commands over a PA system, ramming in a window, and finally deploying a bomb-carrying robot that leveled his house. When Grindel emerged from the rubble with a rifle, police shot him 3 times, once through his cheek.
He knows he's lucky to be alive.
Larry Holmes, Grindel's cousin, was among a handful of family and friends who came to the court hearing to support Grindel.
You don't shoot someone in the mouth, you shoot him in the head. You're looking to kill him. And then 2 in the chest, I mean, have a building fall on you. He's blessed, and he knows it. And I guarantee you, he's not going to screw this up.
Grindel is receiving help in his search for a place to live. In the meantime, he'll stay with the son of his best friend, Lee Bell, who Grindel shot at in the June incident. Bell says he's relieved that his friend is free.
You know, right up till now, we've all been really sick about it. And I'm just really satisfied that things played out the way they did today. Obviously, we can't wait to, get him back.
A GoFundMe page has been set up for Grindel to raise $2,000 to help him get back on his feet. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Finally today, when Maine voters head to the polls in November, they won't just be choosing candidates. They'll also consider a number of infrastructure bonds, including nearly $50 million in spending for the state's university system. University officials are calling it a workforce bond, and they say it'll be an important piece of the effort to address Maine's ongoing labor shortage. Robbie Feinberg has more.
Leanne Oyer Bides is a senior at the University of Maine at Augusta. She's also a mom who spent years working for a local Head Start program educating young children. But in 2014, her position was cut.
That was a scary thought. What am I going to do? Medical, legal. So I decided to go to a legal field. So I came here to register for justice study.
But she found that navigating through this new educational system wasn't easy. First, there were financial aid forms.
Filing FAFSA itself, I had went in there for multiple times because certain issues, and they helped me go through each step. They are willing to contact them on my behalf for some documents.
In addition, English isn't Oyer Bide's first language, so she spent hours every week at the school's writing center. She's close to getting her diploma and entering law school, but it's required her to take as many as 6 courses per semester while working multiple jobs and taking care of her son.
Until last semester, yeah, if I get 4 hours of sleep a day, that's a good day.
Students like Oyer Bide's are more the norm at UMA than the exception. Officials say the average student age here is 33. Many are also the first in their family to attend college.
It is not inexpensive to serve this population of students, and I don't think people always understand that.
UMA President Rebecca Wyke says the school uses online courses and satellite locations to reach students in their own communities, from Rumford to Rockland. But even with support, less than a quarter of full-time students graduate from the university within 6 years.
Larger institutions who have more traditional student bases tend to be better funded than the students who are really focused on working with those individuals who need a little bit of extra assistance to get through.
It's part of why Wyke and other university officials support Question 4, a statewide ballot referendum to borrow $49 million for infrastructure improvements across the university system. At the University of Maine at Augusta, the bond would fund the creation of a consolidated student support center that would bring some services like enrollment, academic advising, and financial aid under one roof. Officials say the center would replace existing offices that are small, cramped, and spread out, making it difficult for students to navigate the layers of paperwork and administration.
So that students know, no matter what my issue is, if I go to this location, there's going to be someone or someones there who can support me as I am working my way through the experience.
Across the entire system, Chancellor James Page describes the ballot measure as a workforce bond to address Maine's labor shortage, brought about by impending retirements in the state's aging demographics.
So in just about every professional area you can think of, the state is going to need new workers, more trained workers, people who really want to build their careers and their professions here in the state throughout, whether it's in Portland or in rural Maine.
Page says much of the bond money would be targeted at boosting the number of graduates in specific majors, such as education and engineering. About a quarter of the money, he says, would go towards nursing, expanding lab spaces, classrooms, and simulators. Page says it comes at a time that Maine could see an anticipated shortage of more than 3,000 nurses by 2025, which could hit rural areas particularly hard.
We're the one institution that has the statewide mandate that can deliver, that has the responsibilities and the skills and capacities to deliver these training and educational opportunities for people.
Historically, Maine voters have tended to support infrastructure bonds, but not always. In 2012, they narrowly turned down an $11 million higher education bond. The very next year, however, they approved $15.5 million for the university system. On this year's ballot, there are 3 other bond proposals for transportation, wastewater infrastructure, and the state's community college system. The bond package totals $200 million. Question 4 has the backing of groups including the Maine State Chamber of Commerce and a political action committee founded by the University of Maine Alumni Association has already spent more than $150,000 to advocate for the ballot question. That effort includes funding for 2 TV ads. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
Education reporting on Maine Public Radio is supported by a grant from the Nellie Mae Education Foundation. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.